This is the World Cafe. I'm Raina Duris. Nothing is ever as simple as it seems on the surface. Every situation is rich with nuance. There are millions of questions to be asked, things to be taken into consideration. In life, there is rarely a quick fix, and Julian Baker knows that. It's been a few years since her last album, Turn Out the Lights, as well as her work with the trio Boy Genius. And on her new album, Little Oblivions, there's no rushing. There's no shying away from the tough stuff. Engineered by Calvin Lauber and mixed by Craig Sylvie, who worked on Turn Out the Lights, Little Oblivions goes deep and gets personal. And that's a good way to describe talking to Julian. She never gives you an easy answer. She doesn't glide over a thought or feeling. It's like she's picking the world apart and examining it in real time. Coming up, our conversation and performances Julian Baker recorded live for the World Cafe, beginning with Favor.
Yes.
That was Julian Baker with a live performance of her song Favor for World Cafe. Her new album is called Little Oblivions, and Julian Baker is my guest today. Julian, hi.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
Welcome. Welcome to the World Cafe. It's great to have you. There's a lyric in that song that we just heard, Favor, where you sing, doesn't feel too bad, but it doesn't feel too good either. Just like a nicotine patch, it hardly works, then it's over. And to me, that lyric kind of gets to something that I notice you exploring a lot on this album, this sort of oscillation between feeling too much, wishing you could feel more, feeling nothing at all, and sort of the fleetingness of those feelings. Mm-hmm. What inspired that particular line?
Actually, the sensation of trying to quit smoking again and using a nicotine patch and feeling like there. I just became very interested in all the tiers of things that we use to pacify ourselves. Like, you know, I've dealt with substance abuse in my life, and inevitably, when you are in whatever stage of recovery you're in, there always becomes something that you like substitute. Like, I chewed so much gum on tour that it was like a problem for many years, because the first time I quit smoking, I just substituted it with 5 winter mint gum, and it was like I would leave a trail everywhere. And then, you know, it's like if I don't do one compulsive behavior of medicating my anxiety with a substance or something, then I would go running. And then it's like, if I wanted to have a cigarette, like, you know, there's like all these sort of pacifying objects that we invent to medicate a need that becomes physical because initially we're medicating something emotional, right? Like alcohol, drugs, anything really. It's like, fundamentally, I think, when those things, at least when they were introduced into my life, I was attempting to numb or soothe some part of myself artificially. Sure. But then this unfortunate thing happens, as it happens with all things that aren't like the real solution to your emotional problems, is the salience wears off super quickly. And then you inevitably just end up in a place where it's like a hamster wheel of pacifying yourself until you actually deal with the like emotional roots of your problems. Wow, just way to dive right in. I'm sorry.
That's I was just like, I mean, that's okay. We're gonna dig into that whole sort of idea of the things we use to pacify ourselves a little bit later on. Before we get to that, because it does sure. show up in some of your other songs, I want to talk about your songwriting process a little bit. Your sure. lyrics are personal and they're very central to your work. Are the lyrics a starting point for you? Are you like a lyrics first and then the music person?
Yes. I would say, I mean, it's so difficult to describe. And I feel like I have this conversation a lot where I'm trying to describe my process, and it's like, most of the time, lyrics are just things that I notice that I write down, and then, or like meaningful events or like pieces of conversations. Like even with Favor, it's like that's just a real story about riding down to visit my family in Jackson and a moth getting stuck in the grill of my friend's truck. And I don't know, I just try to maintain sensitivity to events like that and be open to like what they could symbolize.
I read in an interview that you did that you said finding out the things that sound bad is part of exploring songwriting. So how does, you know, finding out what sounds bad help you find what sounds right?
Well, it's like, I don't know. I think about, I've been doing a lot of cooking in quarantine. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately with cooking, you can't just mute when you put too much pepper.
Yes.
You're just stuck with it. But I also very much like I don't know. I think it's sort of the same. And then it's like every mistake that you make, or like weird guitar sound, or like backwards sample keyboard synth thing that you put in there, you can just sit on. And I don't know, we would just ask ourselves, like, does this serve the song?
I feel like that cooking metaphor that you just used is going to stick with me for a very long time. Like, when I make dinner tonight, I'm going to be like, oh, I should turn up the reverb on this oregano.
Yes.
Were there things, like, can you pinpoint, I don't want to put you on the spot, maybe you can, if you can't, that's okay too, but is there a spot maybe on the record where you can pinpoint something that at first you were like, this sounds weird, this maybe sounds bad, that you ended up really liking and keeping?
I think the example that comes to mind that really illustrates what you're talking about is in Bloodshot, there's this like bit crush guitar part that's just like incredibly over distorted, and also there's like a stutter delay on it, so it's not really in time with anything, and it's kind of just like at this point where it's only my piano and voice, and then this like screeching awful noise kind of like happens. And at first I remember when I was like finding that setting, like you know so much of songwriting for me is about discovering things, and so I'll just like turn knobs and try to make noises that are interesting or weird. And when I found that setting on my pedal board and we recorded it, I was like, I don't know, I think that's too much. And Calvin was like, no, it's cool. And the more that I sat with it, the more I recognized that the element of discomfort that that noise brings to the song is something that I liked.
Well, let's hear it. I'm gonna play a clip of it right now. Here's Bloodshot from Julian Baker.
There's no glory in blood, only the gore of our heart. So let it come from my throat. Take me and tear me.
So from her album, Little Oblivions, that was a bit of Bloodshot from Julian Baker. I'm speaking with Julian Baker today on World Cafe. Most of this album was written in 2019, which was a year you'd kind of stepped away from music in a lot of ways. Could you talk a bit about what you were going through and the context in which you were writing the songs on Little Oblivions?
I had been touring for quite a while, like consistently for several years, and in 2019, I guess it's always interesting to say, you know, it's like I took some time off of the road, but initially I didn't want to at all because I had had a small brief break after the Boy Genius tour was over in December 2018. And it always sounds dramatic when I say this, but I just reevaluated seriously every part of my life and why I believed the things I believed and did the things I did and what my relationship to music was. And I don't know, eventually it just became apparent that I was not in a healthy enough place to be on the road. And so we canceled a bunch of shows, and that was really hard for me. I was furious.
Really?
Playing live music is something I've been doing since I was 15 years old. And when that wasn't my primary directive, I sound like a robot, but like when that wasn't
in Star Trek.
When that wasn't the focus of my entire life anymore, it was really disorienting, honestly. And so I went back to school because honestly, I didn't know what else to do. And there was like a long time, like a several month period where I seriously entertained the fact of like, or the prospect of that I might not be able to do music anymore. Like I wanted to, but my relationship to playing music had become so convoluted in this way that I hadn't expected it to. And
How so? Like, how was it convoluted?
I was in a very unstable place and legitimately thought, like, my label and, like, all the people that work with me are at, basically, like, at the threshold of their willingness to deal with me. So I was like, I might not be able to tour again. Like, I might have actually done it and blown up my life. And so I went back to school partially because I was like, well, I should have a degree if I want to get a different job at, like, an office or something. And then the other part of me was like, I don't even know if it is gratifying to me anymore to try to project an image of myself into the public that I think I can't achieve or that I think isn't true. I don't know. I was overwhelmed with this, like, imposter syndrome. I had put out this record, Sprained Ankle, and then I started doing interviews about God and sobriety and recovery. I was like 20 years old, and I looked back at all of the things that I had been working towards to, like, symbolize or, you know, whatever, tried to be as self-effacing as I could within the context of being a performer, which is an oxymoron by itself. But, like, I don't know. I felt like I had been very misguided, and then I didn't know what business I had telling people anything, you know? Yeah.
We're going to hear you perform Faith Healer next, and it does touch on two of the things that you've talked about, addiction, sobriety, and religion. Mm-hmm. How do those two things blend together in this song?
When I was grappling both with my sobriety and faith, it became apparent to me that both of those things were behaviors, I guess, like the way in which I interacted with my faith and the way that I use substances were behaviors that were trying to suppress or negate a feeling. Both of them had basically been occupying or, like, doing the same job for me for many months, where I was trying to, like, either find relief from anxiety in a compulsive acting out of my belief in a higher power or by dumping alcohol all over my brain. So it's like I started to recognize how, like, so many things, like religious institutions, superstitions, political ideologies, all of the things that give us the illusion of rightness are just things that are, they're just more sophisticated ways to assuage our uncertainty. And it's like with drugs and alcohol, that's on the surface. You're assuaging it chemically. And just because you have to go through some mental acrobatics to construct a belief in a higher power that favors you and protects you, or believing in the ultimate empirical trueness of, like, the Constitution or something. Those are all solutions that are temporary and that are, like, artificial, right? Because inevitably, everybody is dealing with the same thing of trying to escape discomfort.
Let's get into this live performance, because I want people to hear it. It is Julian Baker, Faith Healer.
How it all would tear, and the beauty
On World Cafe, that was Faith Healer, recorded live by Julian Baker. I'm Raina Duras. Julian Baker is my guest today. In the opening line where you say, I miss the high, how it dulled the terror and the beauty, you really seize on the dualities of the experience of like being taken out of your body in a way. I think it touches on something that's important because just because you're sober or you don't find that comfort in religion anymore, or you leave something that is not working for you, it doesn't mean that you don't want that feeling still or miss that feeling of an oblivion or transcendence or something, right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What do you do? I mean, other than chewing gum, what do you do now when you're longing for that feeling? Do you have things that you turn to now that help?
I would have said running maybe 2 years ago. I've been a runner, I guess, for a long time. And the reason why I started running was to deal with anxiety because I don't know, I had been sober for a while, but I was never very athletic and I would just find myself waking up in the middle of the night and having these crazy panic attacks. And so I would go on a run at like 3 a.m. or I would go on a run. Like I remember this time that we were on tour and we stopped at a gas station and I just like Jason Bourne, like rolled open the van door and just like started sprinting a lap around the gas station because I felt like my heart was racing, like I was going to die if I didn't move and the adrenaline needed to go somewhere. Now I try to run as an enjoyable act and I try to make it a time where I'm deliberate and intentional with my thoughts and where I try to spend time if I'm going to ruminate about something. Just observing my thoughts. This, I'm about to use so much therapy language, but it's okay because it's true. Like I went to a lot of therapy. It was like I constantly felt in between this like defensive unwillingness to buy it because it was lame, and then also this beneath that, like a rage that no one had ever just taught me these simple things in like the fifth grade. Like, hey, feelings are different than thoughts. Yeah. Like, I wish somebody had said that to me before I was 23 and I had blown up my whole life about it. But the more that I try to do the work of like sitting with discomfort and like accepting my failures and committing to try to be a better person, the more I recognize just like how exhausting it is to try to dedicate so much mental energy to escaping pain. Like, you know, this is very Eightfold Path, but like life is suffering is true. Like life is full of suffering and we spend a whole lot of time instead of valuing the parts of life that are joyous and accepting the parts of life that hurt, we spend a lot of time avoiding confronting pain. And it's just not possible. And it's very destructive to suppress and ignore those things. More destructive and painful, I would argue, than just confronting them, you know? Like,
sure. We've talked a bit about, you know, growing up religious. How did growing up and having religion be a big part of your life shape you musically as a kid?
For myself and for many of my friends from Memphis, and I'm sure from the South in general, church was my entry point into music. I find so often when I meet other touring musicians that if you go back far enough, most of us were like praise band kids.
Or what's a praise band? What is that?
What is a praise band? I'm glad you asked. A praise band is so like it's hard to describe to somebody who didn't grow up in it. It's like a praise band is when usually members of the congregation of a church who all like play guitar for fun or whatever, play bass, play drums. They learn a bunch of the like K-Love contemporary Christian songs. Okay. And then they like rock out. They play like a couple of songs when people are arriving at church. And then the pastor gives a sermon. And then they go up there and like play, do a little vamp for communion and then play some more songs. And everybody sings along. It's like worship music.
Right. So it would kind of be like where a choir might, like in the times when a choir might sing in a different church.
Yes. Or like whenever, like imagine like the part of church when you're supposed to like open up your hymnal and then everybody sings and then like the one honorary lady that's like 100 years old plays piano.
Right.
That instead of that, it's like somebody in a V-neck sings you like U2, but about God. I'm trying to be funny about it because I think I grew up in that world and saw all the like, I just wanted a place to play guitar, right?
Yeah.
Like I just, when I showed up to youth group for the first time with like my friend or whatever, I was like, I don't even know if I buy God, but there's like a bunch of 20 something 18 year olds hanging out playing like House of Cards by Radiohead on an acoustic guitar in the lobby. So I kind of want to be around these people because I so desperately crave and need access to music and a place to play. So basically, I played with this group of musicians that played at like four or five different churches because it was just like a worship circuit. It was just like session players,
yeah,
but for God. And it was so, yeah.
Like, is there a line there then that kind of leads into sort of like the Christian metal world? Like,
yeah,
I know that that was stuff
sure.
that you were into, like Norma Jean and stuff like that.
Oh my God, I love that you just name dropped Norma Jean. Yes. So I feel like, you know, I was young and maybe a little bit naive and very idealistic and very impressionable and vulnerable. And so when I saw bands screaming about God, I was like, yeah, I am scared that God doesn't love me because not only because I'm queer, although that comprised a large part of my fear, but also just because I'm imperfect. And because I grew up in the South with this whole like idea of original sin and like the worm theology of being nothing, of having no inherent value outside of God. And then, I don't know, imagine being told from the time that you're a baby that the God of the universe is going to decide based on what you say and do whether he loves you or not.
Yeah.
And believing that that's true.
Yeah.
I mean, that's like, how would you be concerned with anything else? I mean, like, it's super terrifying. And it's also like, I think what was important to me about the Christian metalcore scene is that, and what I don't even think that those bands maybe were willing to admit to themselves then, is that they constructed an outsider culture to deal with the feeling of being an outsider in the context of a religious institution that demands adherence to a specific set of rules. And they're like, how do we, like, honestly, those shows felt like a bunch of kids screaming at each other, like, how do we do this? We grew up in church. We don't know what to do. We don't know what is right and wrong. Yeah, I don't know. I'm sorry I got so like...
No, it's okay.
Intense. I was just like, I don't want to risk reducing this very real, very complicated, very loaded thing to a cheesy subculture of like crabcore breakdowns, even though that was what it entailed.
Look, I'm going to play a clip of Norma Jean right now, just because I don't think it's ever been played on World Cafe before.
Yes. Is it what song is it?
Do you want to? I was going to pick Science Fiction. Because I really like the breakdown in that song, but...
Okay, word.
No, you can choose one if you want one.
Memphis will be laid to waste, dude.
All right, let's do it. Yes. All right, here's a bit of Norma Jean, Memphis will be laid to waste, on World Cafe. Can't believe I'm saying that.
It's awesome. What a world we live in. Meow!
Cafe, you just heard A Bit of Memphis Will Be Laid to Waste from Norma Jean, a song chosen by Julian Baker. So, you came out to your parents when you were a teenager. You're growing up in this religious household. What was that decision like then with all of these things that you were around and that you were thinking about?
This also is, and I don't want to give you a monologue about every question that you ask me. It's just that it's important to me, especially now that I have reevaluated how dangerous it can be to misrepresent something in a naive or idealistic way. I have told this story a lot, and I think I used to tell it as sort of this alternative to the way that people imagine coming out to a religious family in the South, because I was like, well, look, my dad, like, I didn't want to come out. It was like an uncomfortable, like, sort of like impromptu thing where I was like, no, I swear, we're friends. As I'm sure many gay people have had that experience. But I tell this story all the time about my dad, you know, grabbing a Bible off of the shelf and being like, let me show you all the verses about how God loves you no matter what. And like, that's awesome. That's really awesome that my dad did that. And that is maybe the purest form of gospel love that I've seen enacted. And I value that. But it's impossible for me to then talk about that as if that neatly tied up queerness and faith for me with like a little bow. Yeah. Like, all right, well, then it's all going to be fine. I don't know. It's just like years of internally wondering if I was eternally damned or not, which seems wild. For that to be a thought that was going through my head all the time. But I don't want it to sound like I'm like slamming people, but it's just like, I don't know. Ideologies can get weaponized really fast. And
absolutely.
Yeah, it's wild.
I'm speaking with Julian Baker on World Cafe. Especially when you're a teenager. Music can be this thing that helps you figure out who you are and helps you figure out where you belong and what all of your big, weird feelings mean. And it helps you feel less alone. I think you probably, I know you fill that role for a lot of young people right now. Is there someone who played that role for you as a young woman who is coming out?
I don't want to retroactively rewrite the narrative of my life as if there was more of a queer presence or a presence of a female role model. You know, I just don't want to like make it seem like I was more hip to things than I was. And in fact, I think it's important to talk about the ways in which much of my music taste was stewarded by like the hetero male culture around me. Like even when I started going to house shows, it's like all of the bands that I listened to growing up when I really needed to like feel big weird emotions were like four dudes making guitar music. And for so much of my life, especially early on as a musician, I feel like I was trying to do a lot of assimilation as self-preservation, but I wouldn't have ever phrased it that way. I think that inherently the queer body and the female body in the world is like threatened a lot, or at least I felt that intuitively I felt that I was threatened by, I don't know, being different. And so a lot of the music that I listened to and literally until I got to college and met other queer women playing music, it was just like me grafting male perspective experience onto my own with like zero nuance.
You are going to perform a cover for us today of Rufus Wainwright, the song Poses. And so I wanted to know, why did you choose this song?
I actually became a Rufus Wainwright fan later in my life. I don't know. I love Rufus Wainwright, and I especially love this song. You get a line like, "Now I'm drunk and wearing flip-flops on Fifth Avenue." That's one of my favorite lyrics of all time. I did go from wanting to be something to now I'm just drunk and wearing flip-flops on Fifth Avenue. And I was like, ain't that the truth, Rufus? We have all been there. You know, it's a song about disillusionment and about how the world can kind of break you. And I think it's fitting that it's told with this tension between like lofty prosaic imagery and really like banal experiences, like just being wasted on the sidewalk. Yeah, I don't know. I feel a lot of attachment to this song. It's very personal to me. And my roommate's dad, who used to play in the Nashville Symphony Orchestra and is a wonderful upright bassist, joined me. So that's cool.
Here it is. It's Julian Baker covering Poses by Rufus Wainwright.
Oh,
Live for World Cafe, that was Julian Baker performing a cover of Poses by Rufus Wainwright. Julian's my guest today. Her new album, Little Oblivions, is out now. The track Song in E, which is the last song we're going to hear you perform, you sing about how it's the mercy you can't take. I don't want to assume anything about what you're writing about, but there was something I kind of took from it where it seems like there's almost this freedom, or like it's a load off in a way to be able to say, okay, I'm just not going to get better at this, versus having someone like tell you that you're forgiven and you can grow and don't worry, you can get better. What can you tell us about this song before we hear it?
Definitely. No, I think your interpretation is accurate. In so many ways, mercy is more uncomfortable, at least for me, than failure. Because it almost seems like, A, there's a moral superiority dynamic where, like, you know when, like, you resent someone and then they're nice to you and you're almost like, are you doing this on purpose to
yes.
make it? Like, that's the pettiest example of this feeling. But also it's like when someone gives you the gift of graciousness or mercy, at least in my mind, because I was raised in a super transactional society, whatever. It constructs this like indebtedness and this responsibility and obligation to that person. And at the time when I was writing this song, it was like I almost preferred if people would just stop telling me that they know I can be a good person, because I didn't think that I could, and I wanted them to just accept that I was a bad person. After talking about being sober and being such a principled person and trying to project that into the world for so long, I almost wanted the freedom of like confessing, you know what I mean? It's like it was almost more work for me to continue trying to make people believe I was good when I didn't believe I was. And now it's just more about, to me, like having disclosed all of these things on the record is more just about, we talked about the sitting with discomfort earlier in this interview, and it's, you know, now it's not necessarily like I feel like I'm being hard on myself, but it actually is a useful tool for me to be able to lay bare all the worst mistakes that I have made, to accept that I cannot change them, and to try to treat people kinder in the future, and to also remind myself that, like, despite those mistakes, I'm a human being who is worthy of love and dignity and respect. And, you know, it's like, I don't think these songs are good because they're musically brilliant. I just think that, like everybody else, I assume, who is making music, they're just a tool to try to be better understood by the world and to better understand myself. And that is why they are worthy, not because they're like bops. But yeah, sorry.
No, I think that's a beautiful place to leave things and to go into this song. It's Julian Baker performing Song in E.
My worst thoughts, I It's the mercy I can take.
Song and E performed live for World Cafe by Julian Baker. Julian Baker's new album is called Little Oblivions. She's been my guest today. It's been wonderful talking to you, Julian. Thank you so much.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
I'm Raina Duras, back in a moment with more World Cafe.